Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, crossover NBA podcast, conference finals edition. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What's happening, Beck? You ready for the penultimate series? Can you say that? Penultimate series, plural, for before the NBA finals?
I think the plural of series is series.
Is it?
In fact.
Yeah. I should probably know that as a writer. I think, feel like I should have that in my vernacular.
That's why we have a copy desk. They'll fix it for you.
That's
no
actually 100% true. I have, and people on the SI copy desk who have known me over the last 20 some odd years that I've been at SI, I have thrown in words that are either completely improperly used or, in the case of one word, not a word altogether. So I've let the copy desk kind of save me a couple of times for sure.
Oh, they save all of us all the time. Thank you, copy editors around the world, for helping us not look dumber than we already project ourselves to be.
Correct.
We're not getting the series we thought we were going to get. I'll say that much. At least to the extent that I think if you turn the clock back a couple of months, Chris, I think it was a given in most people's minds that the conference finals would still involve the two defending champs, that the Suns would be in the Western Conference Finals against somebody, that the Bucks would be in the Eastern Conference Finals against somebody. Those were the two teams that people had pretty well chiseled in, not even penciled in. And wow, here we are. No Bucks, no Suns, no Giannis, no Embiid. None of the top three finishers in the MVP race. Actually, the top four finishers in the MVP race are not appearing in the conference finals, which on balance I think is a good thing. No disrespect to the teams that lost in their fan bases, but the unpredictability, I will continue to say, of the last few years is by and large a good thing.
Yeah. All right. So we get Celtics going up against Miami, 1-2 seed in the Eastern Conference. We get in the Western Conference, we get Steph Curry and the Warriors going up against Luka Doncic and the Mavericks. So I want to look back, though, at how these series came about, specifically the Game 7s we saw on Sunday. Let's start in Boston, where the Celtics, they look like they were in a heap of trouble after Game 5, down 3-2. They've got to go to Milwaukee after blowing a 14-point fourth quarter lead, and they do it. They win Game 6, and then they win Game 7 in what turned out to be a rout against the Bucks. A couple things stand out to me, Beck. The Celtics defense continues to impress. Milwaukee was the third best offense in the NBA last season. In this series, the Celtics held them to under 90 points twice. Now, you certainly can say Chris Middleton wasn't there, and that was a big factor for the Bucks. But the way Boston defended Giannis, Giannis shot 55% during the regular season. He shot 45% in this series. This kind of continues a theme for the Celtics when it comes to slowing the superstar on the other team. Kevin Durant, he shot less than 40% in that series against the Celtics in the first round. So Boston's defense, it's great. And once again, we saw a role player step up for Boston. In game four, with the Celtics season effectively on the line, almost going down 3-1, Al Horford, 30 points. In game seven, Grant Williams, breaking Steph Curry's record for most three-pointers attempted in a game seven. Grant freaking Williams. I thought it was funny. Ime Udoka after the game goes, just, you know, two guys from Charlotte, two Charlotte shooters out there. I mean, Grant Williams was incredible in game seven. And that's what the Celtics have been like in the second half of the season. Great defense and guys stepping up that you may not expect them to step up. Tatum and Brown, they were really good, but the Celtics won that game seven because Grant Williams just went off.
Yeah, and it underlines once more that while we sometimes default to, all right, you've got the superstars. We know who they are in this league. We know who the guys are who change the entire trajectory of a team and make them a contender, that it matters who you surround them with. Role players matter. Sometimes it is the role players who deliver a critical game, as you just outlined for the Celtics. We see that over and over again. We've seen it with the Mavericks, too, in their amazing run to the conference finals, something that nobody saw coming. And, you know, whether it was Brunson or Dinwiddie, like, you have to get quality players around guys. This is a superstar league. It's superstar-driven. They sell tickets. They do raise your floor, but your role players sometimes determine the ceiling. And, you know, I think what the Celtics have done, they kept the core together. They kept Brown and Tatum together. They kept Marcus Smart there. They brought back Al Horford. And guys like Grant Williams developed along the way. And you can't project every piece of that. But it speaks volumes of that organization in not only the drafting and talent acquisition, but in player development. That over and over again, you know who the teams with the best player development are because you see a Grant Williams emerge or you see a Jalen Brunson emerge. And what the Celtics have done is astonishing. It's interesting. Like, this is their fourth conference finals in 6 years, Chris. We don't think of this as some like Celtics-dominated era because they haven't been to the finals during this stretch. And the roster has changed many times in this six-year run, especially at point guard. But been the conference finals for the last 6 years. Like, in any era, any stretch of time, that's pretty impressive.
They've been to 37 of the 75 Eastern Conference finals in the NBA history. That's a ridiculous number. Now, a lot of those, of course, came in the 50s and 60s, and the Celtics were a dominant team, but that's still really impressive and shows just how good this Boston team has been over the franchise's history. Ime Udoka continues to really impress me. This team wouldn't be where they are right now without Ime Udoka. And I was among the more critical people of Brad Stevens' decision to step down. We, you know, checked the tape. I went back. I've said over and over again that Boston should have aggressively pursued someone like Sam Presti and kept Brad Stevens on the bench. I was wrong on that count. Not only has Brad Stevens turned out to be a pretty terrific executive, I mean, his moves to acquire Derek White, to reacquire Daniel Tice, that's among the reasons the Celtics are here right now in these conference finals. But Ime Udoka was the right coach for this team. His coaching style, the bluntness, ruling more with a stick than a carrot, that's what this team needed. I mean, they had atrophied in the years under Brad Stevens. They had some success, as you pointed out, trips to the conference finals, but in the last couple of years, they just needed a different voice, and Ime Udoka was the right voice. To Brad Stevens' credit, he knew that. He didn't go out and look for someone that he kind of lined up with philosophically. In a way, Brad Stevens kind of looked for the opposite of himself, right? Like, Brad Stevens is this lifelong coach who played some college basketball but made his bones in the small college ranks and jumped to the NBA. Ime Udoka, veteran NBA role player, journeyman, if you will, who was an assistant coach at three different stops before he got this opportunity. He found the opposite personality from him, the opposite defensive philosophy. I remember going back to the press conference where Ime Udoka was introduced. We kind of took a good-humored shot at Brad Stevens, saying we got to get that assist percentage up. That wasn't very good last year. Saying that with Brad sitting right next to him at that time. Ime Udoka deserves a ton of credit for that. That's why this guy was number two on my Coach of the Year ballot. I think he's had a phenomenal season all year, really, beginning with kind of getting this team past their early struggles, putting them on that path to where they, you know, ran off one of the best records in basketball in the second half and getting them here to this point right now to the conference finals.
Yeah, there's plenty of credit to go around in Boston. And, you know, Danny Ainge, who was there for that closeout game, clearly once a Celtic, always a Celtic. Doesn't matter that he's now leading,
gotta love that,
leading basketball ops and other things for the Jazz.
Probably try to trade, you know, Rudy Gobert to Boston, like talking like that Rob Williams guy, he's no good.
But like, you know, Danny took a lot of shots from people over the last few years because it was all about like the picks they missed on, as opposed to the picks that they nailed, Brown and Tatum in particular, and getting guys like Marcus Smart. The core of this team is still Danny Ainge's team, and that's not to detract from Brad Stevens. And Brad Stevens went out and brought Al Horford back, and he made the trade for Tice. He fortified this roster in a really important way, and he made the critical choice, as you point out, of who to succeed him, and knew that he needed somebody who coached differently with a different kind of voice and a different style. All that credit to Brad Stevens. But I think Danny Ainge has been vindicated with this run. I don't know that he needed vindication. I didn't agree with a lot of the criticism in the first place, but I think there's a vindication in this. And, you know, Brown and Tatum, ever since they brought them together, looked like they could emerge as the best young 1-2 wing combo in the NBA. And that's where their trajectory has brought them. And Jason Tatum to the precipice of MVP in the MVP discussion on MVP ballots. And Jaylen Brown, a guy who should be a perennial all-star. And they're two-way players. And that's the thing, too. So part of this, you know, look, what's Brad Stevens? What's Ime Udoka? What's just natural progression of young players? Tatum has just gotten better and better as a playmaker and as a defender. That's a responsibility he's holding himself to account for. Not all young players do that, especially if you come in as a really gifted scorer. Not all guys ever branch out. They don't necessarily take on those other responsibilities. Well, you want to be a leader? You want to be MVP? Okay, you got to do these other things. You got to defend at a high level. You got to make your teammates better. You got to pass. Tatum has made those strides. And so if you know, while we're spreading around plenty of due credit, I do think it starts with Tatum, because you go as far as your best player can take you and as far as they are willing to push themselves. And clearly, and he had some rough spots in this series, but he came through when it mattered.
All right, so early thoughts on Celtics Heat. I think the biggest question going in is who's going to be available. Kyle Lowry is still battling the hamstring issue. Ime Udoka, he said on Monday, Marcus Smart would be questionable with a foot issue. That's the latest Marcus Smart injury that he's been dealing with. I mean, I think this is going to be, I think this series is going to be kind of a rock fight there, Beck. I mean, I think you're got two teams that play high level defense. They're both physical. I think it's going to come down from Boston's end. Like, can they slow down Jimmy Butler in the same way they slowed down Kevin Durant, in the same way they slowed down Giannis? Butler averaged 27.5 points in that series against Philadelphia. He shot 51% from the floor, 33% from three. He rebounded at a good rate, about 8 per game, handed out about 6 assists per game in that series. He was great. And so for Boston, you've got to kind of deploy that same defense that was really good against Durant and against Giannis, albeit, you know, Butler plays a different position than both those guys, but you've got to deploy that same defense to have success against Miami.
Yes, though I would just note, and look, this has been the case all season. The Heat, of all the potential contenders that we talked about over the course of the season, the Heat had by far the least potent offense. Regular season, they were tied with the Sixers at 11th, 12th in offensive rating. So, you know, what the Celtics had to do against the Nets with two incredibly talented and versatile scorers in Durant and Kyrie, what they had to do against the Bucks, granted no Chris Middleton, but Giannis is the biggest wrecking ball offensively in the league potentially right now. So I like the Heat don't have that. The Heat hang their hat on defense first, and then Jimmy Butler turns it up to another notch. Jimmy Butler, who will put up kind of, you know, good but modest stats, modest compared to the Giannis's and Durant's and LeBron's of the world. Jimmy Butler will turn it on in the playoffs, and he has. So it's not that he can't do it, but the Heat don't have any one offensive player who scares you the way that that Giannis or Kevin Durant or Kyrie Irving did. So, like, the Celtics have been phenomenal defensively. I don't think they even necessarily need to be as good in the conference finals as they were the first two rounds. The Heat are a different kind of team. The real question is, I think, to me, more, what is Miami going to do to slow down Tatum and Brown? And if they do, if they really disrupt their best offensive creators, where do the Celtics go? Is it Grant Williams hitting, you know, another seven threes? Is it Marcus Smart coming through? Is it the Celtics simply, you know, fighting fire with fire and just holding the Heat down that much further, and they're going to win, you know, 91-87 or something, you know, and take us, set the clock back a couple decades? I don't know. The Celtics have more offensive firepower. That part is clear.
I think a big key for Boston is matching the physicality of Miami. Jaylen Brown said something after Game 7 where he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that he felt like the Bucks prepared them for what's coming against Miami. When I talked to people in Boston before the playoffs, the one thing they were wary of with the Heat was that Miami was always really physical with them during the regular season, and that physicality had an effect. It was good in those matchups. You're probably not going to get any more physical than what the Celtics-Bucks series was. I mean, that was a wrestling match for most of these games. Bodies hitting the floor left and right. So, at the very least, Boston's going to be prepared for the physicality of Miami going into that. And if they can match that, they're going to be in a good position to win. All right, let's look at the Western Conference. Before we go to Mavericks Suns, what the hell happened in Game 7 between Dallas and Phoenix? I mean, this game was over the second quarter. By halftime, Luka Doncic had outscored Phoenix in the second half. It was a 40-something point game in the third quarter. It was a laugher. You know, people were tweeting out, let's do running time in the second half. Second half of Game 7, and that's what happens. Beck, how do you explain the collapse of the Phoenix Suns?
I don't know. I mean, we're not supposed to say I don't know on radio and podcasts, and it's really puzzling. It is something that we have rarely, if ever, seen. It's one of the greatest collapses we've ever seen. It's certainly one of the worst, not one of the worst, one of the most just, I think, catastrophic and dramatic exits by a 64-plus win team. So the Suns won 64 games, right? And by that alone, they were considered the dominant team of this season and of the regular season, right?
Nobody came anywhere near. Let me pause you right there, Beck, because you're right. 64 wins indicates you are a dominant team. But Patrick Beverley, the Minnesota Timberwolves guard, he was on ESPN on Monday, and he had this to say about how fearsome Phoenix really was.
What are you saying to that?
Basketball player, you could see it in their eyes. They were scared. It ain't about Luka taking his soul. They knew starting the game what was going to happen. He's done it before. They watch, trust me. They have iPhones. They have Instagram. They see the numbers of Luka Doncic averaging 39. They hear me saying, man, he did it to me. He did it to me, Kawhi and Paul George. I'm damn sure you're going to do it to them. They know that. Boy, scared of Luka. Ain't nobody afraid of anybody over there in Phoenix, man. Everybody in the league knows that, bro. Like, it's just that y'all don't know that because y'all not in the locker room. No one's afraid of Phoenix. We wanted them. No one's afraid of Phoenix. Yeah. I talked to some teammates. I ain't gonna say who, because I'm gonna say who. Forget it. I talked to Paul George last night, man. Pat, ain't nobody scared of him.
So back, Patrick Beverley, not mincing words there about what he thinks of Phoenix's how fearfully should be of Phoenix.
Well, so my 30,000-foot view of the Suns has been this, and I probably even said it on this podcast, Chris. Were they the best regular season team? Yes. Did I consider them dominant in the way that we consider most championship contenders or teams that we expect to win the championship? No, because they didn't have a Giannis and they didn't have a Kevin Durant or a Steph Curry or a LeBron James or a Kawhi Leonard. They didn't have that guy. Devin Booker's really, really good. Chris Paul's a Hall of Famer. They didn't have it was not a super team. It was just a really well, for the time that they made the finals and for most of this season, a really well orchestrated, very complimentary team that, as I've said many times, they were the classic ensemble, better than the sum of their parts. Like the early 2000s Sacramento Kings, it wasn't any one player who was the most responsible for their greatness. It was all of them combined in perfect harmony offensively and defensively. But that's also why I still had doubts about them and why they were not necessarily my pick to come out of the West when the playoffs began. So real quick, just to underscore how bad this is of an ending for them, 25 teams in NBA history have won 64-plus games. 25 teams. 18 of those 25 made the finals. 15 of the 25 won the championship. So of the seven that did not make the finals, four at least made the conference finals and lost there. So the Suns are one of only three teams in NBA history to win 64 games or more and not even make the conference finals. The other two were the 2015-16 Spurs, won 67 games, lost to Oklahoma in the second round. And then, of course, the infamous 2006-07 Dallas Mavericks, the year that Dirk won his MVP. They won 67 games as well, lost to the We Believe Warriors in the first round. So that's the group the Suns are now in. And where the why, we'll be unpacking for weeks and months to come. But clearly, a lot of this has to do with the Mavericks. Their defense was fantastic. They, you know, blitzed Booker. They corralled Chris Paul. And then on top of that, Luka just had a game for the ages, was absolutely unguardable, absolutely unstoppable. So much of this is just the Luka Doncic coming out party. And it's not always the case that the team with the best player wins the series, but that was damn well the case in this series. Luka was by far the best player in the series. And no, I did not think the Mavericks roster was as perfectly fitting, as well put together as what the Suns had. It's why I expected the Suns to ultimately win it, because I didn't think Luka had enough help. Well, apparently he did. And it certainly raise questions about the Suns now.
Yeah, let me say a couple things first before I get to Phoenix. Dallas has really surprised me. Luka Doncic is on his way to becoming one of the great playoff performers of this generation. He did not get out of the first round in his first two postseason appearances, but both those times he went up against the Clippers, who were a better team, and in both those series he played incredibly. One that was in the bubble and one that was out. So Luka didn't lose that series as much as the Clippers were the better team and Luka didn't have enough help. That's number one. Two, Jason Kidd has really surprised me. Like, Jason Kidd, I didn't think much of him as a head coach, Howard, when he was in Brooklyn, you know, dropping Diet Cokes on his shirt to get a fake timeout. in Milwaukee, you know, I don't think those Bucks teams underachieved, but there was a reason the Bucks front office made the change to Mike Budenholzer, which ultimately paid off. I mean, Budenholzer took that team to a championship last season. So I kind of thought Jason Kidd was all right. You know, he's kind of riding the wave of his playing career. He was a smart player, a point guard, all those things. But I didn't think much of him as head coach. He comes to Dallas, and he does everything right. Like, that team, just like Boston, was mediocre in the first 2 months of the season. But they got it together and went on a great run in the second half. And they did it behind a great defense that was implemented by Jason Kidd. He's got a great assistant coach in Sean Sweeney, who's done a tremendous job with that defense. And he's harnessed the players he has, harnessed the power of the players he has. He's empowered Luka much the same way. Look at Rick Carlisle empowered Luka as well. But, you know, he surrounded him with three-point shooters, and he has used that as the foundation of his offensive attack. Jason Kidd, he pushed all the right buttons in this series against Phoenix. He had his team ready to play on the road in Game 7, and Monty Williams, who deserved Coach of the Year, did not. That Phoenix team was not ready to play. Now, on the Suns, oh, by the way, one more thing on the Mavericks. The Spencer Dinwiddie trade was great. I mean, Dinwiddie looked like a bust during the half season he played with Washington. In Dallas, he has been great when he scored 30-plus points in Game 7. He's a big reason they're moving on as well. He's a big reason they're successful right now, because he just fits as that kind of third guard-ish with Jalen Brunson and Luka Doncic in that mix. Now, with Phoenix, the question I've gotten a lot you know, whether it's text messages with people or doing radio interviews or whatever. Like, was Phoenix overrated? Because now you go back and look at last year. And last year, they got to the NBA Finals. But they got there by beating a Lakers team that crumbled without Anthony Davis, by beating a Nuggets team, which did not have Jamal Murray, and by beating a Clippers team, which did not have Kawhi Leonard. So they had a fortuitous path to get to the NBA Finals. They did not have one this year. And in the second round, they lose 4 out of 5 to a team that, from a talent perspective, they should be a lot better than. So, you know, are the Suns kind of one of those regular season E teams that you have to worry about when it gets to the playoffs? Now, the Suns, they've got a bigger issue. Chris Paul turned 37 during the series, I believe after game 2. It's like his body just decided it was 37 then. Like, before then, he was really good in the first couple of games. After that, he was really bad. The last, what, 5 games of that series, I think he averaged like 10 points per game over those last 5. I'm looking at the numbers right now. In the last 2 games, he scored 23 points and he had 8 assists. He took 15 shots in the last 2 games. It's like he just aged, like literally overnight on his birthday when he turned 37. That's got to be a cause for concern as you look to next season. It's his age 37 season, so he'll be 37 during the year. But Chris Paul looked old in this series. And look, we're not going to play more audio of Patrick Beverley, but Patrick Beverley went on TV on Monday and kicked the crap out of him and said Chris Paul can't guard anybody. Chris Paul should have been benched in that game. And you have to think maybe he's right. Like, you know, the way that Chris Paul was playing in that game 7, maybe Monty Williams should have gone away from him sooner. It might not have made a difference because the Mavericks were a buzzsaw and Phoenix just lay down, but you know, the Suns, they've got some issues moving forward. Chris Paul is going to be back. He said he's not retiring. But Devin Booker is now going to be a supermax player when he signs a new extension. DeAndre Ayton, I don't know what happens there. I don't know what happened between DeAndre Ayton and Monty Williams when he played 17 minutes in Game 7, and Monty wasn't looking to talk about it afterwards. Said it was internal, the decision to bench DeAndre Ayton. Now, after not agreeing to a contract extension with him last year, are the Suns going to full max him out? Is Ayton going to, you know, look for other offer sheets? Is he going to sign the 1-year qualifying offer? Like, that's a situation in flux as well. So the Suns ended the regular season, went from a team being like, wow, that's a finals contender, a championship contender, a team with a lot of young pieces, to now, I don't know what they are. Like, they're a team with a lot of question marks around it.
I thought it was really fascinating when Monty said, quote, it's internal, when he was asked about Ayton only playing 17 minutes in an elimination game.
Well, they went back and forth at each other on the sideline there, if you saw.
Yeah,
right. There was something said between the two.
But it's it obviously hints at something bigger. Maybe that exchange, maybe things that preceded that exchange, maybe things that have been bubbling below the surface all season for all we know. But that, like, when you talk about things that are alarming, like, we can overreact to the blowout loss. We can overreact to going from 64 wins to not making the conference finals. It's the job of the team to step back, take a deep breath at the top levels and say, okay, we still are a team that won 64 games, that was in the finals a year ago, and that has a really great core, most of whom are really young and still growing. But you cannot dismiss Chris Paul's age as a concern. You cannot dismiss what we just saw happen with DeAndre Ayton and Monty Williams saying it's internal. Like, those are real things. Those are, for a team whose chemistry and their camaraderie, all these things, you know, with, like, all the intangibles were all there, right? Why were the Suns, without any established superstars, without having a super team, why were they the team that made the finals? Why were the team that won 64 games and dominated the regular season? Because of all the intangibles, because of how well in sync they were with each other. That doesn't look the case right now. And they chose before the season, Robert Sarver as owner, chose before the season not to extend DeAndre Ayton, or not to give him the contract he was looking for. And they still played well. He still played well. But now that's coming back. Because now, if there is tension between Ayton and Monty Williams, or Ayton and the team, and the contract is now sitting out there as an issue because he'll be a restricted free agent, it starts to get messy potentially in a hurry here. And yeah, Chris Paul can't do this forever, right? Like, he might have another one of these seasons left in him, Chris. He might come back and have yet another All-NBA season in him. But there aren't that many more. And I don't know who eventually replaces him. And we've seen that Devin Booker pre-Chris Paul was a guy who put up great numbers but couldn't even make the playoffs. And I'm not saying that Booker hasn't evolved since then. He has, and credit to him. I think he'll be fine once Chris Paul retires. But Chris Paul will retire, and they will need another playmaker, an elite playmaker, to go along with Devin Booker to keep them at this level. And like those are all very, very real concerns. And look, they knew that from the moment they made the trade for Chris Paul, which was a fantastic deal and has completely changed this franchise. But you knew there was always going to be an expiration date on it because of Chris Paul's age at the time that you made the trade. And so right now they have to be thinking about, how do we keep DeAndre Ayton in the fold? Do we still want to keep him in the fold? Do we want to keep him in the fold at max value when it could cost us like millions or tens of millions in luxury tax payments? And what is our plan beyond this coming season for Chris Paul or for point guard? Because you got to have some kind of plan in place or thought process in place for what's going to happen if he comes back next season and is the guy we saw in game seven, as opposed to the guy we saw for, you know, the first, you know, for the regular season.
Yeah. I also, to look at the series specifically, I thought the Suns got a little too cocky in that series, you know, going up 2-0, some of the shots they took at Luka, probably unnecessary. Maybe poke the beast a little bit there with Luka Doncic. So maybe they learned something off of that as well. But it's a big offseason for Phoenix and an expensive one potentially for Robert Sarver, both of DeAndre Ayton. I think Cam Johnson is also extension eligible. This team could tie itself up with some big contracts for a long time. And if they're the right contracts, great. But you do have to wonder about the future and the ability of this team to be great after watching what they did against Dallas in the series. Any quick thoughts on Mavericks against Warriors? I will say this. If Dallas can find a way to get to the finals, it has some kind of like LeBron and 07 type vibes to it, doesn't it? Like, I mean, not to disparage any of the players on the Mavericks, but like, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie's a good player, certainly better in Dallas than he was in Washington. Maxi Kleber, good player, but we're not talking about an all-NBA, all-star type of guy. Yeah, I mean, Jalen Brunson, good player as well. Like, if Luke is able to push this team into the finals, it will be like a LeBron-like accomplishment, I think. Especially against a team like Golden State, which is capable of playing great defense, has waves of defenders they can throw at Luka, beginning with Andrew Wiggins, continuing with Klay Thompson, maybe even some Draymond Green if they want to get really physical with Luka. Offensively, they can space the floor really well. Like, this is a tough series for Dallas, but if Luka can pull it off, that's the stuff of lore right there, Howard. That's how legacies are made.
The 2007 LeBron comparisons are not wrong in terms of like the context of the team around him, right? Or even the last Cleveland team that LeBron took to the finals against the Warriors back in 2018. It is similar in that there's no single player on that roster that's an identifiable all-star or future all-star. Spencer Dinwiddie, really good player, not going to be an all-star. Jalen Brunson, maybe. I mean, is he on that Fred VanVleet type trajectory? Yeah, I don't know. But like, no guarantees there. Nobody else even close on that roster who you'd say that's a future all-star. So it's Luka and a lot of really good role players. Even in recent memory, like, okay, the Raptors with Kawhi, but okay, Kyle Lowry had made some all-star teams. And Pascal Siakam was an emerging all-star and future all-NBA guy. So like, even those teams, like, there aren't that many analogs for this Mavericks team if they can make the finals. And then, yeah, Luka will be very much like, in the broad strokes, LeBron in 07 with that Cavs roster. Just really impressive all the way around. Against the Warriors, you know, listen, I mean, the Warriors certainly looked vulnerable in their series against the Grizzlies. People can make the case, and it's hard to argue back because it's a hypothetical, but what if Ja Morant doesn't go down? And, you know, granted, the Grizzlies, Ja Morant versus non-Ja Morant is this whole other complicated thing. Do they still beat them with Ja Morant? I think the Warriors win regardless, but they had their shaky moments and got, you know, the snot kicked out of them in one of those games. But they've had time to kind of rest and recover. Klay, game six Klay is always a welcome sight for the Warriors and their fans. And if that is another breakthrough moment for him in this season, where he's just been kind of just piece by piece getting himself back together after 2.5 years off with injuries, you know, really rough injuries. That's a good sign for them. Jordan Poole at times has looked like their third splash brother, and at times has looked like, you know, like he's a little lost. Andrew Wiggins kind of comes and goes. They don't have Gary Payton the second. He's probably still going to miss, the rest of the, at least this series, and possibly the whole postseason. But the Warriors have all the experience, all the championship pedigree. They've got Steph Curry. They've got home court. I got to think they're favored. I haven't checked the odds makers and all that. It's not something I do. I'm sure they're favored. They should be favored. They have more talent overall, and they have the experience. But what Luka has done to this point, what the Mavericks have done to this point, is so impressive that I don't think anything's out of the question.
No, not with that guy. Like, he's great. Like, he's the guy that strikes fear in your heart when he has the basketball. Like, he's unbelievable. And I saw some of those stats, like, outscored Devin Booker, out-assisted Chris Paul. Like, he was, had more steals, I think, than Mikal Bridges. Like, he was just all over the place.
Both of these series could go the distance, Mannix.
Yeah.
I think both of them could go the distance.
I agree. All right, couple things non-playoffs related before we go. Daryl Morey and Doc Rivers had their end of the season availability. One of the takeaways, of course, Doc Rivers will be back as head coach, which I always believed he was going to be back, given the unpredictability of this season, the trade at midseason, the injury to Joel Embiid, all that stuff. But, Daryl Morey confirmed it pretty quickly at that press availability. He also addressed the future of James Harden, who has a player option worth $47 million next season and will be looking to secure a lucrative long-term contract with Phoenix. Here's Daryl when asked about Harden's future with the Sixers.
That's the plan, is to have him back. That's been the plan since the trade. Obviously, we have to work with his representation, and that'll be between us to figure out how that works.
So, Howard, here's my question. How complicated do you think these discussions between James Harden and the 76ers are going to be? And which of these two sides do you think has the most leverage? Because I think it has the potential to get messy and the potential to get real problematic if the two sides don't get on the same page relatively quickly.
I think the question is, how much self-awareness does James Harden have? Is he aware of what he did and what he didn't do, and where he is in his career, and what his actual value is? I was on Zach Lowe's podcast last week with our friend Bobby Marks as well, and Bobby was basically saying, like, there's no market out there for teams to pay Harden the max. Like, that's the reality right now. We'll talk about Kyrie in a minute. It's kind of a similar situation, different circumstances, but Does James Harden have the self-awareness to know that he's not regarded as the guy we saw in Houston all those years, who was a perennial MVP candidate, that he's not playing like that? And it's not just because he's playing with Embiid. Like, you can only have so many postseason pratfalls before, that just becomes the belief in who you are. Like, that's the proof. The proof is that this is you. Not the couple of times you came through, but all the times you didn't. And the Sixers have a lot wrapped up in him. I mean, your leverage question is a good one, because Harden has the leverage in that the Sixers traded Ben Simmons and picks and Seth Curry and Andre Drummond, all that stuff, to get him. And the investment is there. Like, they are linked to him, and they can't very well replace him with similar talent. But the question is, what is that talent? How much can they rely on him? So, and does Harden have the self-awareness too about the fact that, look, you have to know, you're not a guy who's kept yourself in the best of shape. And it has haunted you. And he can say it's the hamstring over the last 2 years. Okay, fine. But all that still goes back to your fitness and your conditioning and how much time you're putting in the offseason and showing up in shape. So everything starts with that conversation first. Before we even talk about, does he opt in and then you extend him? Is it a max? Is it short of the max? How much short of the max? How much of a discount is he willing to take, if he's willing to, as he kind of hinted at in his final press conference? All of it starts with the conversation about where he is in his career and what he's committed to do, or what he's willing to be committed to do. And it starts with himself and his body and his game. And then everything else flows from there.
So the obvious blueprint is what the Suns did with Chris Paul, right? Where Chris opted out of the last year of his contract, which would have been worth $44 million, took about a $14 million per year haircut in that first season and signed a deal with more money on the back end. The Suns are protected a little bit on the back end with some non-guarantees there as well. So I'm sure that's what the Rockets are thinking, but you're right. I don't know what James Harden is thinking. I think James Harden has a lot of leverage in this situation because if he doesn't get what he wants or what he's most comfortable with, all he has to do is opt in and collect a $47 million check next season. Like, that's a lot of leverage to me. Like, you know, and he could, it would be a risk for Harden because he'd be betting on himself. But I'm sure somewhere in the back of James Harden's mind, he remembers that it was just like a year or so ago during that first half of his time with Brooklyn that he was playing like an MVP candidate. I remember this because I had reached out to Harden's camp to write a story about him playing like an MVP candidate. So are those days gone forever? Is his body so broken that he can't get back to being that player? I mean, Joel Embiid, God love him, like, put him on TV more too. Like, he came out and said, you guys are expecting the Houston James Harden. That guy's not there. That guy's not in the league anymore. This guy's more of a playmaker. Is that what James Harden is at this point? Or does a full offseason, a more productive summer where he spends it working on his body, working on his game, comes to training camp in shape, has a full camp with Tyrese Maxey, Tobias Harris, Joel Embiid, all that whole group of Sixers. And does he come back looking more like the Harden we saw during the first half of that season in Brooklyn? And that would be a risk for Philadelphia to take, to go into next season with Harden potentially becoming an unrestricted free agent. So I think these negotiations are going to be fascinating. And I think a lot of it, you know, I think the relationship between Harden and Daryl Morey is going to be tested here. Like, you know, does Morey ultimately cave to what Harden wants because he has such an unflinching belief that James Harden is still a great player? Or, you know, does he draw a line in the sand at some point? Does ownership draw a line in the sand at some point and say, look, we'll pay James Harden X, but if he wants Y, not going to go there. Let him opt in. Let him opt out. Like, I wrote about this on SI.com. Like, you know, James Harden now has, what, like 6 weeks to kind of survey the landscape and see what's out there. I know what Bobby Marks is saying, but don't be surprised if a team emerges that's interested in James Harden. You know, Houston, would they want a reunion with Harden? Maybe. I'm looking at Portland, which has the ability, I think, to clear close to max cap space. And if the Blazers strike out on some of the guys they might want, like, to maximize Damian Lillard, is adding Harden to that mix something worth doing? Like, I think he's going to have some options in free agency if he chose to go that route this summer. And it's just a dicey game that Philadelphia's going to have to play where, you know, if you can bring James Harden back on the long-term contract you want, that's best case scenario. But there are a whole lot of worst case scenarios out there for the 76ers if things don't go their way.
Yeah, I mean, look, for the Sixers, I don't think they want to even contemplate a quick divorce with James Harden. They probably also don't want to contemplate a five-year max with James Harden. So yeah, the answer is somewhere in between in terms of comfort level. Bottom line is you need a co-star for Joel Embiid. It was supposed to be Ben Simmons. That soured. You held out, I think, rightly. Again, Daryl Morey made the right decision in deciding I'm not trading Ben Simmons until I get a established star in return. He got his established star in James Harden. Maybe it's the wrong star, but he succeeded in his goals. Is Harden now the right guy? They have to have somebody. And if it's not Harden, like, you can't, if he just walks away, if he opted out and walked away, you're screwed. No matter how good Tyrese Maxey looked, no matter how much you get out of, you know, Tobias Harris or anybody else, like, you're in trouble if you have Joel Embiid with no true co-star. And so that is not an outcome they can entertain. I don't think that James Harden at this stage, listen, two messy divorces in an 18-month span, James Harden's going to do this again? And that act alone is going to scare off teams. Like, I don't think anybody's going to trip over themselves trying to sign Harden to a max deal or anything close to it. The Bobby Marks lists the teams that will have at least $30 million available, $30.5 million available in cap room this summer. It's the Pistons, who of course have Cade Cunningham and a young group. They're not going all out to go sign a James Harden. Pacers, rebuilding mode, and they got Tyrese Halliburton. That doesn't seem to make sense. The Spurs, they've got DeJounte Murray, and then the Magic. The Magic have, you know, nothing really going for them, and maybe might as well. Is that where James Harden wants to go?
Well, I would say this, Howard, like, you don't
and the
have
Blazers
cap
can, and the Blazers can get
yeah,
cap room.
You don't have cap space until you do, you know.
Right, and there's sign and trade possibilities too. We've seen plenty of that. You can engineer it to somewhere else that wants you, and you could figure it out. All right.
Well, let me just real quick. This will also test like whether Harden really wants to win, right? Like,
yes.
You know, he said all along, I want to go to a place where I can win championships. Philadelphia represents that type of place. He's got a 28-year-old MVP candidate in Joel Embiid. Tyrese Maxey's only getting better. Harris played really well at times in this postseason. Like, of all the teams you're mentioning, Philadelphia offers James Harden the best chance to win.
Of course. And look, he forced the trade there. And by some reports, that's where he wanted to go initially anyway, when he was forcing his way out of Houston almost 2 years ago. So it is on James Harden to fix this. It is on James Harden to fix himself and to recommit himself to the game and to commit himself to the Sixers, to Morey, to Embiid. That's it. It all starts and ends with him. If in fact, listen, there's also this other possibility, of course. Sometimes guys, especially guards, just fall off a cliff at some point in their early 30s and they're just no longer a superstar anymore and can't do what they used to be able to do. If that's the case, they're all screwed. But if this is simply a case of James Harden having gone through a couple of years, difficult years with injury and maybe some conditioning issues, whatever else is behind it, then it's easy to fix. Easy for me to say, but easy to fix. James Harden, just go recommit yourself to the game and to your body and to your game, and find the best way to maximize this moment in your career and this partnership with Joel Embiid. And if James Harden can approximate the Harden we used to see in Houston, but as a complementary piece to Embiid, then maybe they will back up all those boasts of a new era, Shaq and Kobe, although that was always ludicrous. But that possibility of being this devastating 1-2 punch is still on the table if James Harden is willing to do the things necessary to make it reality.
Yeah. A lot of that's going to depend on this offseason. And like, we'll know like September 25th or 26th of a training camp's open, just how seriously James Harden took the offseason if he's back with Philadelphia. Last thing for you, Beck. Kind of flew under the radar last week. Sean Marks had his end of season media availability in Brooklyn. And Marks was asked about, you know, Kyrie Irving and how the team is going to handle Irving's future. Irving, of course, can be a free agent this summer himself. He's got a contract. He can opt into the final year. Here is what Sean Marks said.
Yeah, look, I think that's something we've been discussing and we will continue to debrief on and discuss throughout this offseason. And it's honestly not just Kyrie. I mean, you bring Kyrie up, but we have decisions to make on a variety of different free agents throughout our roster. We haven't had any of those discussions yet, so it'd be unfair for me to comment on, you know, how it looks with us and Kyrie, because to be quite frank, he has some decisions to make on his own. So he has to look at what he's going to do with his player option and so forth like that. But I think we know what we're looking for. You know, we're looking for guys that want to come in here, be part of something bigger than themselves, play selfless, play team basketball, and be available. And that goes not only for Kyrie, but for everybody here.
Howard, I thought that was an interesting statement. I just did. Like, in a situation like that, the easy thing to do is, like, we love Kyrie, you know, we'll figure something out. But Sean Marks mentioned availability, which tells me that, like, Sean kind of knows that while, you know, COVID has receded across the country, the winter months, it can come back. And one of the first cities that's going to implement restrictive, you know, movements, restricted laws, it's going to be New York. And we could be right back where we started with Kyrie Irving if he's not able to play home games in New York. What did you take from Sean Marks' comments about Kyrie?
Yeah, listen, Sean Marks comes from the San Antonio Spurs culture and the Spurs school of never say anything interesting ever. So for Sean Marks in a postseason exit interview with the media to actually say, you know what, We need our guys to be committed. We need everybody committed. We need guys to be available. And to actually, instead of saying the obvious thing, which every GM almost always says when it comes to when they're asked about a star player and his contract status, we want player fill in the blank to finish his career here. We see ourselves with player fill in the blank for years to come. He didn't say those things with regard to Kyrie Irving because he couldn't. He couldn't say it with a straight face. So for somebody who plays his cards so close to the vest, Sean Marks really said a lot. He didn't say a ton. He wasn't very elaborate, but what he did say and what he did not say told us a ton. It told us that the Nets, just like all of us who were observing the course of their season, are sitting back going, how can we rely on this guy? How can we possibly rely on Kyrie Irving? We've got, you know, arguably the best player in the game in Kevin Durant, and we've got two other stars. And three stars in this league, if they're the right fitting stars, should make you a championship contender, not getting swept in the first round. But you got one guy who missed most of the season because of his anti-vaccine stance, and another guy who, for whatever reason, Ben Simmons wasn't playing. We don't need to go down that path. Eventually, he had back surgery, and that's leaving his status in question, too. So how much do they think they can rely on either of these guys? And what will Ben Simmons' health be next season? Like, on paper, they've got three stars. On paper, they should be a contender next season. But that's like the flimsiest on-paper version of on-paper contender I think I've ever seen. Because I don't know what those two guys are going to do, how many games they'll play. Ben Simmons has never played a minute with this team. We don't even really know how he fits with them or what he's willing to do in terms of sacrificing some playmaking and all this. Like, there's a lot of question marks for a team that, again, on paper is a super team. But they were on paper a super team when they had Durant, Kyrie, and Harden. Like, they've just keeps going from one volatile mix to the next. And this seemed to be the first moment in this time period where Sean Marks basically said, it's time for the franchise to retake control a little bit here. Like, we have to start making the tough decisions and holding these guys accountable, because there's a ton invested in them, both financially and competitively. And, you know, I'll just say this. I don't think you can go into next season with both of them. You can't go in with both Kyrie and Ben Simmons, because you can have one volatile, unreliable, unpredictable star. You can't have two. And whether that means trading Ben Simmons, who's under contract and is probably the less alarming player for most of the league, if you can reassure people that his back is fine, Ben Simmons, I think most teams in the league would still give you something valuable for. I know his value has bottomed out on some level because of he hasn't played in a year and he just had back surgery. But Ben Simmons is younger, and he's a unique commodity, a 6'10", 6'11 guy who can guard every position on the court and handle the ball. And is still young enough to be able to evolve. But Kyrie at this point, I cannot think of a single team in the league that would want to take a chance on Kyrie. But I don't envy the position that Sean Marks is in right now. They are capped out. They're in the tax. They have no flexibility. They can't just afford to let Kyrie walk if he opts out. You can't afford to give him a max deal either. Same thing as with Harden. You cannot give Kyrie Irving a max extension or a new max deal if he opts out. You just can't. And it was really interesting to hear Sean Marks in that press conference. By the way, one other quick footnote on Kyrie. He changed representation again this season. Kind of flew under the radar, but he was with Jeff Wexler.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was with Jeff Wexler for a very long time, a veteran, really respected agent in Jeff Wexler. He fired a couple of years back to hire Roc Nation. This season, he fired Roc Nation and hired his stepmom. And I don't know what that means for Kyrie's office. And you can always go back and out and hire another agent. You can go hire CAA or somebody tomorrow if you wanted to. But this is a really critical juncture in his career, and he's got an inexperienced agent and one who's, you know, not part of any of the major agencies besides, and is just a family member running the show for him right now. And it's not to say that she can't do a good job. It's just that there's no experience there. And it doesn't always go well in this league when you hire family members instead of established representation.
I wouldn't offer Kyrie anything in terms of an extension. I don't think you have much of a choice when it comes to him coming back next year and playing alongside Ben Simmons. I think that's, you know, I don't know that Ben Simmons has any trade value at this point. I mean, you kind of
threw it out there saying, like, if you convince teams his back's okay. I mean, the guy did just have back surgery that, you know, purportedly is going to keep him out for a few months. I don't know that you're going to be able to sell teams that Ben Simmons is healthy. Plus, there's the willingness to play, you know, wherever he goes. Like, there's just too many question marks around Ben Simmons. But I think the big thing is, I think the Nets should say to Kyrie, you want to opt out and become a free agent, go for it. Let's see if you can make that money back in a deal. Let's test your resolve to play with Kevin Durant over the long term. If he's willing to take a very team-friendly deal on an extension, then maybe I'd consider. But otherwise, play out your contract, man. Like, and let's see what happens next year. Because next year, like you said, like we said, who knows what's going to happen with COVID? Does Brooklyn become kind of a problematic place to play for players that won't get vaccinated? Will Kyrie ever get vaccinated? Clearly, that's unlikely. I wouldn't offer him anything. I'd say this is where I'm willing to go. If you don't want it, opt in, opt out, whatever. But we're not paying you anything more. Like, that to me is the big decision.
And it's not just about COVID. I mean, yes, a COVID resurgence and reintroduction of strict rules. Right? It's availability in general, and also just how committed you actually are to the team you're with. I mean, let's quickly review here. He makes the shot of his career in Game 7 in the 2016 Finals, and the Cavs win the championship. A year later, he's forcing his way out of Cleveland and forcing his way away from LeBron James, the greatest player of his generation. So does he really want to win when he's forcing his way out of a team that has LeBron James and that has gone to the Finals every year that LeBron has been there? So he forces his way out in 2017, goes to the Celtics. He misses their entire playoff run. They go to the Conference Finals without him. That's 2018. 2019, he does play in the playoffs, and they get bounced in the second round by the Bucks 4-1, and he seems weirdly disengaged. Of course, all along the way, he'd been talking about how he's going to, you know, he wants his name in the rafters in Boston, wants to stay the rest of his career, and lo and behold, 2019, he goes to Brooklyn instead. Then he misses most of the 2019-20 season with the Nets because of injury. Doesn't come back for the bubble even, I think, after being healthy at that stage. And then the 2020-21 season, remember, he checked out for 2 weeks for reasons that weren't entirely explained. Might have had something to do with the, you know, the insurrection at the Capitol. Might have had something to do with others. Who knows? He just checked out for 2 weeks, didn't play. And so it's not just COVID in this past season and his refusal to get vaccinated. He's got a now running track record of just being unreliable or disengaged or checking out at the wrong time or mentally checking out or losing interest in the team that he's with or whatever. Again, he's played in 103 of 226 potential games with the Nets. Since arriving in Brooklyn, he's played in 103 of 226 regular season games. Like, I mean, that says it all. And not all of that is injury. And at a certain point, if you're the Nets, you just have to, you know, you just have to decide whether or you know, make a judgment. Is this guy really with us? And it's hard to say.
It sounds like Sean Marks is getting ready to make that judgment. And, yeah, you know, public comments like the ones we heard last week are the strongest we've heard to date about where the Nets stand, where Sean Marks stands about the future of Kyrie Irving. Howard, good stuff, man. Headed to the Combine with me this week. We're going to be Combine buddies.
Actually, I've bailed out at the last minute on Chicago. Oh, well, I'm going west instead. I got to go see some Warriors Mavericks.
Oh, well, I guess then I'm all by myself. I'll be in the lottery room on Tuesday, ready to roll.
You really will be lonely. You'll have to give up all of your electronics.
I saw the list. It's going to be me and Sam Presti will be in there. Tommy Shepard will be in there. You know, no electronics, but can I bring a flask in there? Is that allowed? Like, can you?
A flask?
Yeah, a flask.
Of like
booze,
bourbon.
Yes.
Yeah. There's no, to my knowledge, there's no NBA rule against flasks of alcohol in the lottery room. Right. As long as the flask does not contain any Wi-Fi capabilities.
Correct. Yes.
Or cell service.
The worst part about
that, good.
I'll discuss it next week on the podcast, my experience in there. I've done this a bunch of times, and I'm sure you've done it as well.
Yes.
Like, I mean, you'd love to bring a tape recorder in there, like, just to be able to record. Like, you can get some interesting stuff from some people in the room, but, like, just frantically writing things on a notepad is not great for accuracy of quotes right there.
In the old days, the first time I ever went in, you were allowed to at least bring your digital recorder so that you could at least tape interviews that you were doing in there. Then they ruled those out because now everything and under the sun somehow has a Wi-Fi signal aside from perhaps your Flask. Could I also just note that
you never know.
So every team sends two representatives. There's the one who's locked in the room with the ping pong balls, as you will be, and then the other representative who's on the stage representing the team publicly. I love the fact that the Thunder are sending Nick Collison, who is listed on NBA media info as Nick Collison, Thunder legend. Love that.
Yes, yes.
Legend.
Liaison with that that team. And Sam Presti gets in the room. Well, there you go. Sam, see you there. You can't have any of my Flask. Howard, we'll do this again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.